Good morning. In the geothermal contest of state authority versus home rule, for the moment, the state seems to be winning. Later this hour, we'll talk with Michael Colicchini, Senior Director of Hawaiian Affairs for Orma Technologies. And a watch and sports trophy guy speaks out against the proposed ivory ban. Mark Carson joins us in just a few minutes. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop. Guitars are the family business for Pepe Romero Jr., whose father is a flamenco and classical legend. He'll join us in our studio. And the Hawaii Pacific University Department of Arts, Humanities, and Languages is presenting a free concert, Moonlight Serenade. We'll get a preview.
On a pie day that's always gluten-free, it's The Conversation. Coming up next, a look at the news. Just a little something to get you going on a Monday morning. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Welcome to The Conversation. Hello there, Chris Vanderkoop.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Good to be back.
Nice to have you here. I know you had to be away on Friday, but good to have you back on this Monday morning. Now, if you're a parent of a kid on a sports team, you may have more than a few mementos from the trophy house. So it might strike you as a little odd that the owner, whose business has no use for ivory, has become an opponent of the bill to ban the ivory trade in Hawaii. Mark Carson designs watches in addition to his sports trophy business, and those watches don't use ivory either. We talked earlier, and I asked him why he'd get involved with an issue that has nothing to do with his business.
Well, I'm a member of the Hawaii Jewelers Association, and I'm speaking today just as a private citizen. I became aware of this pending legislation, and reading through it, it struck me that this is basically the government encroaching on personal property rights. I have no dog in this fight, as they say, meaning I don't own, buy, or sell any ivory. It just seemed offensive and wrong to me, and I was hoping that the legislators could appreciate some of the more subtle aspects of it, because there's legacy ivory, which is legal ivory, that's been out there in the hands of collectors and individuals for many years, decades in fact, and that they need to make provisions for protecting property rights while they're trying to balance that with animal rights.
Those who have crafted the latest version of this bill think that they've done that. You don't think that they have. What do you think needs to be done further?
Well, a couple things. I actually submitted a draft to them. Of course, it was late in the game because they've already gone through their committee hearings. There's a couple things we'd like to see, those of us who are trying to keep the property rights so that tutus, Ming's jewelry, can be passed down to their grandkids. And if the grandkids say they don't want to wear it and they want to sell it at a garage sale or eBay or Craigslist, they're free to do so without, you know, legal repercussions. They don't want to be arrested and sent to jail or have their property destroyed on a second offense. The things that are currently wrong with it is that there's no distinction between pre-ban and post-ban ivory. For convenience, let's call pre-ban ivory legacy ivory, which is legal ivory. And that's ivory that came into the United States, imported legally before 1972, generally considered to be 1975 for the Asian elephant and 1990 for the African elephant. And really, the African elephant is where the carving is done. So what that means is that if they would have said things that are prior to the bans are legal and remain legal, that would be good. That would be what people are looking for. And there's some other minor issues, such as they include mastodon and mammoth. Typically, mammoth is still in the current draft of the bill. It's been extinct for like 10,000 years. We're not going to save those animals. And their only defense of having it in there is they say, well, it's hard to differentiate between one kind of ivory and the other. And that's simply not true, because people who are experts in the field have field test kits, some of which were developed at the Smithsonian. And you just carry this little kit that has samples of ivory, and you have like a 10-power magnifier, which is a loop, jeweler's loop, and you look at the ivory, and you can tell, for instance, mastodon and mammoth from elephant ivory, because in the structure they have a different angle as to how it's kind of put together. So a field test by trained fish and wildlife enforcement officials could easily differentiate and exclude most mastodon or mammoth ivory, so there's really no reason for it to be in there.
You mentioned the idea of, you know, being able to pass along ivory. That can happen because there's nothing in the bill now that would prohibit that. It would be fine to be able to pass it along. Your issue is if that person would want to sell it, that this would destroy its value, which is precisely what the proponents of this bill want to have happen in terms of ivory sales. The idea that you could sell it on eBay, though, is already prohibited. Now you cannot sell ivory on eBay at all.
But that's not a legal requirement. That just happens to be an eBay policy. But the notion is that you couldn't go sell it. Let's say a garage sale to make it real simple. The way the bill is currently drafted, it's a little more restricted than what you would say. You'd think you could give it away to anyone you want. The answer is no. You can give it to your heirs upon your death, your legal heirs. So it's even an encumbrance to do it that way. You're not free to just give it out. And by the way, it's not that they're trying to destroy, I think, the trade in legal ivory. I think they just didn't think about legal ivory. What they're trying to do is to make sure that illegal, so-called blood ivory or fresh kill ivory that might have slipped past the border, you know, through the customs agents, doesn't wind up floating around to the market here and we don't become a local market for ivory.
Which we, in effect, already have because we're number three in the nation.
Well, they say that, and it may be true. Unfortunately, you have to also look where the statistics come from. Those numbers come from the wildlife organizations, which are NGOs, non-governmental organizations. These are not numbers that are coming from the federal government. They're not numbers that are coming from the African governments. So I'm not saying the numbers are right or wrong. All I'm saying is they haven't been vetted or verified.
Well, they are being agreed upon by the Humane Society.
Well, okay, if you're talking about the Humane Society of the United States, let's keep in mind that these are not the people that are running the animal shelter. I adopted a cat from the Humane Society years ago. It's not those people. These people do not run animal shelters. They are the people on TV asking for all your money. They currently have $100 million they've put in the Cayman Islands, so they're real good at collecting money. They're very stingy at passing money out, and when they do, they take credit for the actions of other people. Mostly what they do is they have paid lobbyists who come here, and their job is to get laws passed. So they have a self-interest, an economic interest, which I personally don't even have, in having something done. So their motives are clearly somewhat tainted, you might say.
At this point, when you look at the legislation and the intent behind it, which is to stop illegal ivory trade, and as we hear from conservationists, to stop elephants from disappearing, you also have a real issue with that. Why?
Well, I don't think anyone that I've run into who has an interest in the property rights of legal ivory, we're all in favor of the elephant, and we all think that the current poaching is just an abomination. It's terrible, and it's against the international treaties, the so-called CITES, which is the International Treaty for Endangered Species, which the U.S. is party to. We have the Endangered Species Act here in the United States, so there's a lot of good things in place already at the federal level. What we think needs to happen is more enforcement where it's actually occurring. And by the way, so you know, the ivory trade really has an axis that is, it comes out of Africa, it typically goes to Southeast Asia where it's often worked or carved, and then it winds up in the rest of Asia, primarily China. China is the number one market by far. And the U.S. is trying to engage the Chinese government to give a perception change and get the Chinese people to realize that this actually kills animals. I had heard that the Chinese populace at one point thought that, oh, the animal is just having a tooth removed, like you went to the dentist, not realizing, of course, that the animals are slaughtered very brutally, and then the ivory illegally taken out of the country. Again, it goes en route on that pipeline to Southeast Asia and on in to China. But the big thing is that the poaching does exist because it's economically of benefit to the people in those poor countries where the poaching does provide some income to them. So what we need to do is help these people, perhaps by sending U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents at the federal level into the African countries to help them with enforcement, with technology, to help them be less susceptible to the corruption. In other words, we need to stop it where it's occurring. We don't want the elephants killed so they don't even become part of the international trade, most of which does not flow into the U.S. and almost none of which comes into Hawaii. The actual market for illegal ivory in Hawaii is almost non-existent.
For a lot of people, the idea that you have to get this at its root or its base may mean that even some of this legal ivory needs to be devalued.
Well, we don't really have a huge market here in the first place. So really what they're doing is they're stirring up an issue that doesn't really exist. I asked Representative Yamani, who's actually in my district as well, and he's one of the authors of Bill 2502, where he got this from. I said, are your constituents actually crying out for this, or is this actually coming from people like the Humane Society of the U.S.? And he said, candidly, well, we get a lot of email blasts, which means at the start of the legislative season, all the lobbying organizations that have an interest in legislation all over the country, they just flood the legislators with the same proposals. In fact, when this thing started off, there were, I think it was 7 or 9 bills in the Capitol all saying essentially the same thing. These were just people who were responding to the emails that got flooded to them, thinking that there's a demand where I don't know the populace is saying there's a huge outrage going on locally. One of the big things we'd like to see is have the word knowingly put in. For instance, when you're dealing with coins, like counterfeit coins, it's against the law to knowingly sell a counterfeit coin. We'd like to see similar wording if it has to go into a bill for ivory. In other words, if you knowingly sell post-ban ivory, then by all means, you should be going to jail and having it fined and confiscated. If, on the other hand, you innocently sell something, sure, it's going to be confiscated, but that shouldn't be the criminal act of someone who made a mistake just for the general populace, like at a garage sale. The biggest thing is we want to see protection for things that is pre-ban.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Mark Carson designs his own line of watches and does not own, buy, or sell ivory. He is a member of the executive board of the Hawaii Jewelers Association, and along with his wife owns Trophy House. A longer version of our conversation is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Find table space to say your social graces, bow your head, they're pious here, but you and I, we're pioneers, we make our own rules, our own room, no bias here, let them sell what they are selling, there, no bias here, so gather all the rebels now, we'll rebel rouse and sing aloud, we don't care what they say, no way, no way.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16, and coming up, the behind-the-scenes artistry of the master luthier. But first, your quiz.
Today's Backyard Quiz and a segment a little later in the show will take us to Hawaii Island, commonly referred to as the Big Island, and that name is well deserved. As the largest island in the United States and one of the most isolated, Hawaii Island is home to many unique and diverse natural wonders. Today, we're asking you about the natural phenomenon with a supernatural name. Often, golden strands of volcanic fiberglass form when lava is ejected into the air. If you can name that, you'll be today's winner. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get the HPRT.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting the Midtown Men, four original cast members of Broadway's Jersey Boys singing hit songs of the 60s, this Saturday and Sunday. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
Pepe Romero Jr. was born into the world of guitar. He's the son of a world-renowned virtuoso who learned his craft from his father in turn. It's a legacy Pepe takes seriously as the luthier who crafts instruments for his father and for local guitar and ukulele player Daniel Ho. Their new collaboration with Pepe Romero Sr. is called Aloha España. It's music that takes Hawaiian music back to its country of origin, one where the craft of the man who made the instruments takes center stage. Pepe Romero Jr. is with us this morning. Good morning, Pepe.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Sure. By making guitars for a collaboration between your father, renowned master of so-called Spanish guitar, and Daniel, who plays slack key and ukulele, it's kind of taking Hawaiian music back to where Hawaiian music got its guitars from, doesn't it?
Very close to the same region. So the ukulele is coming out of Portugal, and my family's from Spain. And I see the same passion over there. Along with the ukulele, they brought the passion, and the Hawaiians have brought that to a whole new level.
Sure.
So putting Daniel and my father together, bringing these two worlds together, and no more passion can come out of these two musicians than anybody else. So they did really a beautiful job bringing these two instruments together, realizing my vision as the ukulele as a classical guitar.
Yeah.
And it's really a beautiful project.
When you make an ukulele, with your original experience was making classical guitars, and you branched into ukuleles, is that right?
Correct. I started building guitars 20 years ago, classical and flamenco exclusively. And in 2011, I started building the ukulele after a family trip to Oahu, where I came with my wife and my daughter, and we fell in love with the island. We went home, and my wife and daughter wanted ukuleles. So They asked me, we were in a music shop, they said, when are you going to make us ukuleles? I said, well, now. And the answer was now, because I fell in love with it.
Well, you can't beat that for incentive, right?
Right.
Plus, they're not going to leave you alone in terms of getting their results, right?
That's right. So it happened, and it turned into this beautiful, a parallel career in ukulele building, and then I started a production line of instruments, and lots of great things have come from that.
When I hear a great classical guitarist, and inevitably is playing a great guitar, It has an enormous, given that it's a nylon string instrument, they amaze me with their projection, right? The ability of that sound to just come rocketing out of the sound hole in that instrument, because it needs to be able to go from fortissimo to quiet and with strength all at all volumes, right?
Right. We're building these instruments for a player to be able to sit on the concert stage in a hall, unamplified, and project piano or forte to the back. Yeah. Everyone needs to hear it clearly. So, and all you have is the instrument. So the acoustic properties of that instrument need to be just right. The woods need to be great, and it needs to be built in a manner that can facilitate the player to do that.
Well, you played a little bit of the ukulele you brought in with you earlier, and that's the thing that struck me right away was the way the sound jumped out of it, was the projection of it.
Oh, thank you. And that's definitely my vision and where I come from in building classical guitar. That's the knowledge that I bring to my ukulele building in how to make an instrument project and vibrate. I say properly. I should say in the classical technique.
Yeah.
So I apply all those principles to my ukuleles and have the same demands as far as projection, tonal character, sustain, and all those demands that I have on my guitars.
Well, could you play a little bit for us with this? You've got
ukulele
with you.
I'd be happy to play a little something.
Sound out of that. Now, part of that is choice of woods, right?
Yes.
The choice of woods for the top.
The choice of wood, that's a great question, because what I see in my ability to build a great instrument lies within the woods themselves. You know, we're taking the trees from the forest that have stood for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And the quality of the cut of that wood and the environment that it grew up in and the whole history is there lies the potential for sound.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to select the wood, I have to cut it properly, treat it properly, and I can't put more sound into an instrument than what the woods have in them already. So I'm trying to unlock their potential.
Yeah.
This instrument has a German spruce top and a South American rosewood body, and that wood combination right there is...
It's one of the most popular,
one of the most popular, and it's like having the best tools in your toolbox.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to give me the best potential to make a big sounding instrument that's going to sustain and have warmth and tonal character and beauty. So starting with the best woods, I have the best chance to make a great instrument.
Because you look for things like kind of a tight grain so that the sound bounces off the surface of the wood, that kind of thing.
That's a typical... character that a great piece of wood has. What I'm looking for more than anything is a feeling in my hands when I take a raw piece of wood and I want to flex it.
Uh-huh.
I want it to spring back a certain way in my hands. And as I work that piece of wood, I thickness it to a certain thickness, not depending on the measurement, but how it feels in my hands. So different pieces of wood that have different grain structure and different width of grain spacing feel differently, so you have to thickness them and work them in a different manner. according to that.
It's as much art as science is what it sounds like, Pepe.
Yeah, it's you tap into it's almost a religion, you know. It's you try
if it's
and
done
tap
right.
In, it's you go within yourself.
Yeah.
An instrument builder who's in love with what they're doing really puts themselves into that instrument, and you have to trust your intuition and your hands and then your previous knowledge as well.
Well, Pepe, great to meet you, and thanks for coming in this morning.
My pleasure.
Pepe Romero Jr. is a luthier whose guitars and ukuleles are featured on the new CD Aloha España, a series of duets between his father, Pepe Romero, and Daniel Ho. You can find out more about the project on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Station members are choosing continuous monthly giving as their preferred way to financially support Hawaii Public Radio and its work. Mahalo to Robert Okuda of Honolulu, Carl and Judy McCluskey of Kapolei, and Sammy Choi of Honolulu for their sustaining memberships. Sustaining membership is steadily lowering the amount of day-to-day operating support needed to be raised over the air. If you'd like to become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Now, despite all the conversation about police reform, a recently proposed settlement in a long line of other settlements has critics saying that reform just isn't happening. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair looks at the latest $4.7 million the city may be paying out for HPD, and why it may not be the last time. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Let's talk about this last case. That's a lot of money, and it's on top of a lot of money that's been paid out over the last 10 years.
Right, as well as nearly $1 million in legal fees just in this case alone. It involves racial and sexual discrimination, a case against HPD, and it dates back to 2010, and it involves three officers that were in situations where their officers are alleged to, or rather their supervisors, are alleged to have not provided backup, an African-American officer, a Mexican-American officer, and a white woman officer. And the white woman, by the way, was later injured and disabled in an incident, again, involving a lack of backup. They have made allegations of sexist and racist comments leveled against them, unfair treatment at HPD. And to add to that, a second lawsuit was alleging that the police department and the city attorneys actually hid evidence and conspired to clear the defendants, in this case, HPD.
Now, some people may not be surprised at this latest go-round, given what we've been talking about for many months now, well over a year, and seeing that cases of similar settlements have popped up and been paid by taxpayers. That's a lot of money over the last 10 years.
Well, in the meantime, Chief Louis K. Aloha, who's subject to an FBI investigation for possible corruption and wrongdoing, remember, he just got a great annual performance review. The police commission said he was exceeding expectations. One wonders what exactly went into that evaluation. But
or what those expectations were.
Yes, exactly. Similar cases, people that Anita Hofschneider interviewed in her story, including Willis Sparrow, the state senator, who's really been on top of this, is saying, look, no one's been disciplined in this case. And instead, what's happening is taxpayers are now being placed on the hook for a whole heck of a lot of money. I mean, this is nearly $6 million in this latest case. But is anything being done to change the what is described as institutional racism, and I might add perhaps sexism as well, at HPD. That is the concern, is that nothing seems to be changing.
And Willis Barrow has been bringing that up several times. Did you talk to him for this?
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, he's been pushing things at the legislative level. But remember, there's also a proposal before the Honolulu Charter Commission that maybe have the mayor have a greater involvement in the hiring and firing of the police chief. At this point, the police commission has that. So it really has to be at a number of levels. But Sparrow called this report disgusting. That's the word that he used to describe this latest incident involving HPD.
All right, we're going to leave it there, Chad. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bethann.
And Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and we'll be back tomorrow with another reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, it seems that the health care you get kind of depends on where you are, doesn't it?
Oh, isn't that always true? You know, even throughout the United States, there's a variability. But today we're going to talk about global health. And the guest that I have is coming from Shriners Hospital, Dr. Paul Moroz. And he's actually done a lot of missions in Haiti and done other sorts of opportunities to really outreach in the Pacific Rim. So we're going to talk about what are the true differences in medical care in the developing world, and how does that really translate into what we can do here at home.
Not only is medical care different in the developing world, but the diseases are different, right?
Well, they are, and they're coming. I mean, when we think about where did Ebola come from, where about chikungunya, that's a viral infection from mosquitoes that we're seeing, you know, even Zika virus that we see, dengue, mm-hmm. All of these types of infections may start in another location, but they directly affect us here in the islands, and people here can get sick. It really is more of a global health priority, and we need to start looking at it that way.
Well, you also have to look at the way health care is delivered in the countries of origin of these diseases like Zika that are just newly emerging.
Absolutely. And if we don't address some of the health care needs there, then these are going to become issues that come also closer to us here in the islands. So it really is in our best interest to try and improve the global health of the population and not just try and just keep ourselves healthy or just our local community, because other things in other locations can really affect us. And we'll talk more about what that means on an average practical basis this
afternoon.
And
Kathy, this is a perspective we don't often get, true.
You got it. It'll be learning for me, too.
Great. Thanks a lot, Kathy. That's
Thank
The
you.
Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting the musical comedy A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, opening this Thursday. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
On The Next Humankind,
life is a banquet. And the tragedy is that most people are starving to death.
We remember the provocative teaching of Anthony DeMello, one of the 20th century's greatest spiritual thinkers. He fused Buddhist mindfulness with his Catholic faith into a message that resonates today. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, we touch base with Christopher Phillips to see what's going on. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. For this week's Stargazers, look out for Mars and Jupiter late in the evening sky. Mars will be rising around 11:30 p.m., and Jupiter will be a little bit earlier at around 6 p.m. The Moon will be passing through its first quarter phase this week. This will make stargazing more challenging as the week goes on.
So I heard you mention Mars in our roundup of things to look for, and I understand that there's a Mars activity in the news.
There is indeed. This time, it's the Europeans' turn to visit the Red Planet with their ExoMars mission. This latest venture is designed to answer once and for all whether there may be life on the red planet.
Now, how is this different than the missions that the U.S. has already done there?
So the last major mission to Mars was, of course, the Curiosity rover, which we sent a few years back. Now, Curiosity was sent to Mars to study the geology primarily of the red planet. That means looking at rocks and studying the environment. ExoMars, on the other hand, is going with the intention of hunting down life beneath the Martian surface.
So how does that work?
Well, this mission is a two-stage mission. And in fact, the Europeans are following NASA's footsteps. They are sending a robot rover to land on the surface, but they're also sending a spacecraft that will back up the rover. And this spacecraft will stay in orbit around the red planet. It will be able to monitor the red planet, but most importantly, it will act as a communications relay to any instrument on the surface.
And do we have other stuff that's orbiting Mars right now?
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. It's actually getting pretty crowded around Mars. There's a whole host of orbiters continuously in orbit around the red planet, and also there are several rovers still on the surface.
And so what kind of tools does it have, Christopher, that this thing can try to figure out if there's life up there?
Well, the rover itself is packed with scientific instruments. There's over 10 high-tech, cutting-edge instruments on the rover itself, as well as a portable science lab. But most importantly, the rover carries a large drill. This drill will drill into the Martian surface down to a depth of around 2 meters. This is much, much deeper than anyone has managed to drill into Mars before.
Wow. Christopher Phillips, and another fascinating edition of Stargazer. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we asked about those naturally occurring strands of fiberglass that sometimes occur during volcanic events. Although not unique to Hawaii, the name of this phenomenon has a distinctly Hawaiian name. Formed when lava was ejected into the air, small droplets are caught by the wind and stretched into thin strands that appear golden and hair-like upon cooling. Although it's known informally by other names around the world, such as mineral wool or witch's hair, the internationally recognized scientific name for this type of lava formation is Pele's hair, named, of course, after the Hawaiian volcano goddess Pele. And Pele's hair is today's answer.
And David Molesky called in from Kihei. He knew the answer, and he will be receiving the T-shirt. He also said something. He said that he's not a member, but he says he should be. He loves the show. I love it when folks reveal themselves. Thank you very much, David. Enjoy your T-shirt, and thanks very much for playing with us for the Backyard Quiz. It's now 8:39, almost 8:40, and if you've got a Backyard Quiz for us, send it to us at Hawaii Public Radio, at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Whatever barriers once existed between genres of music, classical, popular, jazz, rock and roll, those barriers came down some time ago, and everyone benefits. Today's student musicians can step from one style to another at will, and generations to come are likely to be more versatile than any before them. Teresa McCreary, Director of Performing Arts at Hawaii Public Pacific University, is preparing a free weekend concert that will take her charges from classical to Broadway and back. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Chris. And let me just start out by saying thank you and to Beth Ann and to everyone at Hawaii Public Radio for supporting us and allowing us to come here and promote our concerts. And, you know, HPU is all about community engagement, and we are always looking for opportunities like this. So we know that HPR is the community engagement center of Hawaii.
Well, where would we be without each other, Teresa?
That's right.
How many students have you got in your these various ensembles?
Well, right now there's about 25 to 30 members in the International Vocal Ensemble, the HPU Orchestra, and the HPU band.
It used to be, and we were talking about this a little while ago, it used to be that when you made your choices as a student of what kind of musician you were going to be, there were these two roads that diverged in a wood, right? One of them being band, one of them being orchestra.
Right, yeah, and you kind of stuck with your thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you were band, you were a band person. If you were orchestra, you were, we called them orchestra dorks and band geeks, and the choir people were in a league of their own, and we all made fun of each other.
Sure, and say if you wanted to be a drummer, chances are you wouldn't interact much with, say, violin players.
No, ne'er shall the two meet.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. But this concert is a real mixture of all of the above, as well as in terms of repertoire. We will be doing everything from popular to classical art songs.
Does that reflect a trend in music education in places like HPU?
I think so, and I think a lot of it comes from we who are classical musicians realizing that we've been rather elitist for a long time now, and we need to cross over the barriers into other genres and other different types of ensembles, because we know that this is what audiences love.
Yeah.
They love, you want to appeal to as broad an audience base as possible. So for this concert on Friday night, there's something for everyone.
Well, it's also it's a very different skill set, yeah? I mean, I remember, for an improvising musician, it can be surprising to have a classical musician, the kind of musicians people like me think are on a huge pedestal, to say, how do you know what to play when there's nothing but a chord chart in front of you? How do you improvise through a chord chart? You know, where does that come from? It's not part of a classical education necessarily, is it?
No, it's really interesting how now we realize how many things we have in common with each other,
mm-hmm.
and how much we respect each other for our differences as well. So one of the national music education standards right now is actually teaching improvisation in the classroom. So we know that this is important from a very basic music education standard.
And it's not as if that's something new in classical music. Bach and Beethoven were improvisers, right?
That's right. That's right. Exactly right. And now we need to figure it out in the 21st century.
So there's a certain amount of coming full circle in just in the way classical music is taught, is what it sounds like.
I think so. I think we're coming around to realizing that we all have something to offer from all of each of our worlds.
Well, because, you know, when you compartmentalize, you can get a long way down the road and then realize there's things that you don't know that you might wish you had, right?
Right, and it is that old adage of we all wish we had something we haven't got.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's actually, like I said, there are a lot of things that the worlds have in common.
Yeah.
And when you start to really look at those and listen to each other and listen to each other's music, there's a much deeper appreciation for all music.
Well, you mentioned to me earlier that one of the classical pieces you're playing, or one of the pieces your classical ensemble is playing, is an Astor Piazzolla composition. And he comes from the very not respectable, if you will, world of tango.
You're right. It's a sexy, slow tango that HPU Orchestra violinist Brendan Ratchford will be playing with us. He's actually playing it with a piano accompanist, by Astor Piazzolla, and it is, yes, most definitely an adventure outside the classical world. But at the same time, we have classical music at its best. We have an Italian art song being performed by HPU tenor Philip Harrison. We have a beautiful piece called Sacrum Convivium by Francis Poulenc. This will be sung by members of the HPU International Vocal Ensemble. And an aria from Puccini's La Boheme. Everybody loves La Boheme, right?
You bet.
by HPU soprano Nikki Villion. She will be performing that. So it's an all-student solo and ensemble, small ensemble concert featuring more of the individual talents of the HPU music students.
And, you know, you mentioned, I suppose the Pulak would be an example of art song.
Yes, and of sacred music as well.
And the discipline is a little bit different from singing opera, for example. Certainly different from popular music, yeah?
Oh, yes, very different. And there will be some popular, I think there's a little bit of Dolly Parton in this concert, and maybe even some Mendelssohn. So it's a big, wide mixture repertoire and ensembles. It's this week, Friday at 7 p.m., it's a free concert.
We'll send people your way, Teresa. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
McCreary is the Director of Performing Arts for the Hawaii Pacific University Department of Arts, Humanities, and Languages, presenting the free concert, Moonlight Serenade, this Friday evening at the Lutheran Church of Honolulu. It will include solo and small group repertoire from early classical to Broadway and pop from three different music ensembles. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
On Hawaii Island, the split within the community over geothermal energy is nothing new. This legislative session, it's taken another turn with a bill to clarify who will regulate geothermal development and exploration. The bill would give that authority to the state unless granted to the counties. Opposition has been fierce, filling much of the 140 pages of testimony from the last hearing. But what about the company that already operates a geothermal plant in Puna, and as of last month had pulled out of negotiations for another project to generate an additional 25 megawatts? Michael Kalakini is Senior Director for Hawaii Affairs for Ormat Nevada, the company which operates Puna Geothermal Venture on Hawaii Island. He joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for giving us some time this morning. Certainly, Ormat understands that there is a great deal of conflict over further geothermal development on Hawaii Island, and we've seen a lot of acrimony within the community because of that. Given all that, how do you assess this bill?
Well, our position on this is that we support the purpose and the intent, because what it's focusing to do is to clarify that regulation of geothermal resource development and geothermal resource exploration shall be reserved by the state unless, you know, it's delegated to the counties by statute.
Doesn't that put you at further odds with the community?
You know, there has been opposition with the community because of this bill. But, you know, the regulatory oversight of all geothermal resources in the state, it needs to be with the agency that has the expertise, it has the human resource, the knowledge to safely protect, you know, our natural resource and ensure safety of all that's involved. And that means the community, too.
Yet the community is going to continue to have these kinds of discussions. And when you read through the testimony, you know, it's pretty intense. Is there any way that you can see that home rule could be maintained in any of this?
Actually, home rule can be maintained. And that is still available. You know, the county will still have responsibility of the location. There will be community hearings required. The DLNR has to comply with Sunshine Law, so there will be opportunity for community input and feedback.
As Ormond has now somewhat stepped back from the process, given the fact that last month you withdrew from negotiations for that additional proposal, do you feel that Ormond can be involved in this discussion regarding this bill, or that you simply have to stand back and wait?
No, Ormond has taken a position. We have submitted testimony during the last hearing at Ways and Means at the Senate, and we are working with the state legislators on our position, and we look forward to the hearings that are going to be scheduled on the House side.
Well, what about with the community, though? There just seems to be such a breach there.
Well, the community, we have our quarterly community meetings, and we have our next meeting scheduled for March 24th at the Pahoa Community Center, and everyone's invited. And if anyone who shows up has questions or comments or concerns about this bill, we'd be happy to discuss that.
And what about questions regarding why Ormond pulled out from the negotiations last month?
Well, we have some responses that we can share. We just could not come to a mutual agreement, and that was a result of not coming to, that's why we was pulled out.
But according to you, you said that that was based on the fact that the requirements for the proposals weren't economically viable. What happened then between last year when you got the contract and now?
Well, that's been submitted in the report at the PUC. The Independent Observer, HELCO, has submitted their reports on what had happened. And yeah, you're correct. We could not come to an agreement on the economics to make the project a viable project. So we had decided to pull out after great efforts. We're very disappointed, but in the end, a business is not going to make a decision to go forward if you're not going to be successful.
Part of the success with geothermal on Hawaii Island has also been a big conversation within the Hawaiian community itself. And we've seen a split, you know, of community within community. Does this further cleave those communities?
Could you repeat that, please?
Well, you know, as we've gone through the conversations about, you know, what kind of portfolio of energy Hawaii Island might be developing, certainly geothermal has been among those conversations. But they've also been the subject of a lot of conversation within Hawaiian communities, you know, who should really have ownership and authority over it. So it's more than just the community at large, but really looking at what this means for Native Hawaiian communities and ownership. Has this conversation and this bill caused a further split within Native Hawaiian communities?
Yeah, I understand what you're asking. And this bill does not address the Hawaiian community and who should own the resource, et cetera. There has been other legislative activity in the past, you know, for example, with Department of Hawaiian Homelands. But this particular bill, SB 2535, does not address that perspective.
Well, that's kind of the point that I'm asking you about, because it's, you know, in saying that if it's going to clarify and say that the proper authority belongs with the state and not necessarily with communities unless it's already been granted by statute, doesn't that also mean that this conversation that's been brewing within the Hawaiian community, and certainly, you know, OHA just put comments out for this bill,
right,
doesn't that also deepen that split too?
You know, it may. It may. There are different positions that different entities are taking, but our position is that the oversight, the regulatory oversight of the actual development and exploration of the geothermal resource needs to be with the agency that has the expertise, the knowledge to oversee it safely for everyone and to protect the resource. And there's no other agency, whether it's, you know, Hawaiian Homes or the county, that have that expertise today. Now, that could change in the future, and we could address that at that time.
All right. For the moment, we're going to leave it there, but thank you very much for making yourself available.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Kalikini is Senior Director for Hawaiian Affairs for Ormond, Nevada. SB 2535 is now with several committees in the House.
Jacket off. I've been searching Nordic City, make me sweat. I'm biting fire.
My name is Tyree Jenkins. Being an underwriter, it's like a double blessing. First, I get to support my local public radio station, which is such a source of wonderful information and entertainment. But also, it's a great business decision. Hawaii Public Radio is one of the most listened to radio stations in Hawaii. The listeners are smart, and they're the type of people that I want to have as my patients.
Hawaii Public Radio, celebrating partnership, building community.
Just for a moment, I want to jump back with you and talk a bit about your conversation with Pepe Romero Jr.
Yes.
I wish for a moment we could have been able to have this as a video project, because just looking at that gorgeous instrument that he built and the sound that was coming out of that as I came down the hall at public radio was just absolutely amazing.
Well, you know, the art of the luthier, and it is very much an art, is one of a very precise understanding of the properties of different types of wood. You hear luthiers talking about Brazilian rosewood. Unfortunately, a lot of the so-called tone woods that are especially popular are from now what are now endangered trees. So there's a whole movement to stop using that type of tone wood, even a move toward artificial types of wood. But the real connoisseur wants real wood of special varieties.
Well, it was wonderful to be able to see it, and wish we could have heard more of it today too. But we will, perhaps in a future version of conversation. Meanwhile, we got to say goodbye for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to check in with Neil Conan from the farm.
And Manoa Valley Theater breaks out the togas for a new production of A Funny Thing.
If you want to talk back to us, you can do that on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive on hawaiipublicradio.org under The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.